WVW Broadcast Network and The New American are pleased to present The New American TV. This broadcast is committed to helping you understand the truth behind the news. Now, here's your host, Paul Dragoo.
Welcome to The New American TV, where we bring you the truth behind the news. It's Tuesday, March 28th, and I'm your host, Paul Dragoo. Here are the stories we're following today. Once again, a mass school shooting has shocked the nation. Yesterday, a 28-year-old woman armed with three guns broke into Covenant School, a private Christian elementary school in Nashville, Tennessee. She murdered three faculty members, including the head of school and three 9-year-old students. Police said officers shot and killed the shooter, who was a former student at the school, in a lobby area in the second floor of the school about 14 minutes after the initial 911 call came in. The shooter turned out to be a female who identified and dressed as a male. Police have said the attack was well planned, with the killer in possession of detailed maps of the school. According to the AP, the Metropolitan Nashville Police Chief told reporters that they had a manifesto and they were going over some of her writings. And Michigan's Democrat Governor Gretchen Whitmer has struck down her state's Right to Work Act. That bill protected employees in Michigan from being forced to fund a union against their will. Now unions can force membership on workers and make them pay dues as a condition of being hired or staying employed. Michigan is the first state in 58 years to repeal a Right to Work Act. That's thanks to the fact that for the first time in 40 years, Democrats completely control Michigan's state government. Besides taking away workers' rights and making the state less attractive to businesses, Whitmer's Right to Work repeal will ensure that unions have more money to donate to Democrats. Meanwhile, Republican U.S. Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky has introduced a national Right to Work bill, S-532. The legislation has 22 co-sponsors. Here's Paul's description.
Recently, I introduced the National Right to Work Act, a bill that would give workers across the country the protection against forced union dues already enjoyed by the residents of 27 right to work states. In right to work states like Kentucky, union dues are voluntary. Anyone can join or pay dues to a union, but union bosses can't force workers to pay dues against their will. In non-right to work states, workers at a unionized workplace can be forced to give money to union bosses, whether they want to or not. When union dues are compulsory, there's nothing holding union bosses accountable. They're free to represent the interests of some workers at the expense of others, or even worse, their own interests over the interest of any workers. They're also free to spend workers' money on political causes those workers don't support, never knowing they'll ever lose a dime in revenue because workers are forced to pay them no matter what. The National Right to Work Act resolves these problems without adding a single word to the federal law. It simply deletes the provisions that allow union bosses to collect forced dues. Kentucky's right to work law has been an incredible draw for jobs and investment. Our entire country should have that same advantage.
South Carolina Republican Congressman Joe Wilson also introduced a companion bill in the U.S. House, H.R. 1200. 48 of his colleagues have co-sponsored that legislation. So joining me to discuss today's stories is Executive Senior Editor for The New American, Steve Bonta. Hey, Steve.
Hi, Paul. Well, I can't think of two more diametrically opposed or different stories.
Yeah. Well, those are two national stories, and obviously the shooter story is, as we said, it's tragic. It's a shocker. I guess one of the things I found interesting about that was that this transgender person was a student once at a Christian school. And I don't know if, you know, depending on what we find out in the future, if that had anything to do, you know, with her animosity or anything. What do you think?
Well, it's easy to speculate. I'm sure we'll have more to say about this in the future, but it is certainly clear that the shooter was ideologically motivated somehow. The police have already made it clear that there is a manifesto,
right,
various writings that I gather were retrieved from the shooter's car, which was parked outside the school.
Is that what they say?
So they had that all that early on. However, as of right now, as of the time of this broadcast, I don't think any of it's been released. They've released the name and some personal details, but apparently the person in question was a transgender woman. I can never keep that straight, but apparently transgender woman means a woman who identifies as a man in some sense.
Yeah.
Although she retained a female name, but yeah. she dressed like a man. She worked as a graphic designer or something like that.
Okay.
And it's just not clear at this point, you know, where she's coming from, but I would bet dollars to donuts, as they say, that there's some kind of perverse ideology
wow.
that we're going to find out about in coming days behind all of this.
I would go out so far as to say that anyone who does that has some sort of perverse ideology. I mean, it's demonic to go in there and kill three nine-year-old. I mean, okay, obviously it's not okay to kill anyone, but I mean, how do you do that? How do you walk into and kill three small children that have that you don't know, have nothing to do with anything in your life?
Well, I mean, I would say that it comes in the first instance from the rise of nihilism in the United States. Recently, I've been reading some of the works of a guy named Michael Polanyi, a scientist turned philosopher from the 20th century, who had a lot to say about freedom, its enemies, and the relationship with nihilism. And he points out that Americans and more broadly people in the Anglo-American portion of the West have a really hard time understanding these kinds of fanatics, who are not obviously just in our day. There have always been people yeah. that have carried out these sorts of atrocities, you know, terrorism and all the rest of this, you know, acts of extreme political violence and radicalism and so forth. And it's very hard to understand the motivation of people like this because normal people have a moral compass, whereas nihilism implies not having a moral compass. But as Polanyi points out, he called the morally inverted people. Mm. Moral inversion is when you abandon morality, substitute for it some species of nihilism, but then
call that your morality.
Right, but it becomes, you pour that same passion and zeal, perhaps even more so, into this new anti-morality. Because human beings, I think there's something deep-rooted in us that will batten on to some cause or another that we're willing to defend. And so when that cause becomes nihilism, which is the absence of a belief in anything beyond material reactivity or something like that, then it becomes easier to justify what normal people would see as acts of absolute heinous cruelty. And this is true. Obviously, Marxism is nihilist. And so I remember vividly back in the early 80s, the mid-80s, there was a Marxist revolt in Peru called the Sendero Luminoso, the Shining Path. And these were actually a Maoist guerrilla group that sought to overthrow the government of Peru and replace it with a Maoist-style government. And at one juncture, circa 1985, just before national elections, these people kidnapped a little girl, like a six-year-old, a girl from Ayacucho or somewhere up in the Andes, which was an area, the highlands of Peru, which is considered to be a sort of a swing state area.
Yeah.
And they cut off the fingers of her right hand. And then they returned her to her parents. And then there was this picture that was sent all around the world of this little girl holding up her maimed hand. This is pretty horrible stuff.
Yeah.
But the point was they were making an ideological point because most of those people were illiterate, so they voted with their fingerprints, right?
Mm.
And so the idea was if you dare to vote or vote against us, this is what's going to happen to you. And they, from their point of view, logically thought, well, the more shock value, the better, the more effective, so we're going to do it to a little kid. You know, that's how these people think, if I can dignify the process with that word.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And so we see the same thing with many of these, probably all of these mass shooters in the United States.
I think it could just be as simple as, I mean, obviously what you're saying sounds true, but it's just demonic activity. And this is what happens when you have a lack of the right divine spirituality, is that you don't see through God's eyes, and this is it just simply comes down to demonic activity. What do you make of the right to work legislation? So what happens if they pass this federally? Does that mean that that Miss Whitmer's law in Michigan will be nullified, or can she still invoke states' rights and say, well, no, we're going to stay in this direction?
Well, she could if she wanted to. I mean, what we're seeing in Michigan, unfortunately, is the slow death of a really great state. Michigan's a wonderful place.
Yeah, we're right nearby. That pains me, too.
It's neighbors, like, are, well, you know, brace yourself. It could be coming to Wisconsin next. You know, we have a very important election coming up this month or next month,
which we'll be covering soon.
And but you know, Michigan is at the point where they're completely. I mean, you know, Michigan has known for a long time. They've had the example of Detroit, which has been run by radical Democrats for the better part of 60 years.
Yeah.
Okay. And Detroit is now a post-apocalyptic wasteland, literally.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. It might as well have been nuked. Okay.
Yeah.
That's what happens. And so it to me, I guess, it's hard for, I mean, I'm not from Michigan. I'm not smitten by the mitten, as they say. But so I don't understand what's going through their heads when they have this clear example. You know, here's what you get when you have unopposed, you know, monolithic, democratic, liberal governance in Detroit's largest city and once one of the largest, proudest, and most vital cities in the United States, and you end up with this hollowed-out shell. And so I guess I don't understand the logic that says, well, you know, let's get some more of that for the entire state of Detroit. So we shouldn't be surprised.
Ironically, then correct me,
Michigan, I mean.
Correct me if you think I'm wrong on this, but my understanding is that part of the one element that helped Detroit just turn into the wasteland. I mean, in the 60s, it was thriving, as we know. It was Motor City, whatever. Right. But one of the things that turned it into that is that unions gained ultimate power over the automotive industry. And so that is that not part of, I mean, so if considering that's correct, like you said, why do we want more of that?
Well, you know, I think on principle, there's nothing wrong with workers organizing. People have a right to form associations. What's wrong with many unions, and I don't want to broad brush them all, but what's wrong with many of them is this coercive element.
Yeah.
Where they excuse acts of violence against scabs, as they used to be called, you know, people who dared to go to work and defy a union declared strike and so forth and so on. And all these other coercive measures, you know, forcing people to pay union dues, even if they, you know, because they work for a unionized company, even if they don't necessarily subscribe to the goals of the unions. And in practical terms, you know, in many cases, particularly with the larger unions, coming from Pennsylvania, which has a lot of unionization even today, had many friends who worked for unions, involved with unions, and a lot of times, again, not to characterize them all this way, but a lot of times, union dues take a hefty bite out of your paycheck and yet don't get a whole lot in return.
Yeah. I grew up in the suburb of Atlanta, and one of the things I learned over the years, I grew up in those times in the 90s and early 2000s when Atlanta was just exploding. And one of the things we kept hearing, it was such a friendly atmosphere for business. Companies kept moving, they kept moving there. And obviously it was a friendly business atmosphere, the opposite of what it looks like they're doing in Michigan. So let's look at the rest of our stories. So he's back. The former head of Project Veritas, James O'Keefe, is at it again. Last night, the new O'Keefe Media Group released a teaser video about a new blockbuster story that is to be released today. The story is about Democrat donation harvesters. O'Keefe broke with Project Veritas in February after he reported a dispute with the organization's board. Before separating from Project Veritas, he was placed on paid leave of absence while his management decisions were investigated. Shortly after, he shared a video of himself issuing a final statement to Project Veritas employees, during which he said, quote, "I've been stripped of my authority as CEO and removed from the board of directors," unquote. Many commentators believe that O'Keefe was indispensable, and it didn't go unnoticed that his break with Project Veritas came after he reported what many believe was the biggest story the guerrilla journalism outlet had ever done. They got a Pfizer executive on hidden camera talking about mutating the COVID virus so that injected people will continue to infect one another and thereby creating the need for more and more vaccines. Let's watch the teaser for O'Keefe's upcoming story.
Now we gotta go to his home.
Now, who are you?
I'm James O'Keefe with OMG.
Okay, if what you're asking is, am I in favor of somebody getting to the bottom of all this, yes.
That's what we intend to do.
I see a scar on his f***ing head. Now stop f***ing the beat.
Whoa, I think we're onto something, folks.
Wow, did that just happen?
I wish I could have donated $18,000 to Biden's presidency.
Really is back at it again. And in Texas last week, pandemonium broke out in the state legislature when a trans activist went on an unhinged rant. He compared state legislators to Nazis for supporting legislation that withholds public money from libraries and other state-funded institutions that host drag shows. The activist refused to give up the microphone, and another trans activist blocked other lawmakers from getting to the microphone.
By hiding your bigotry behind children like cowards, you will find yourself on the wrong side of history. By manipulating the words of an ancient text and shoehorning it into legislation aimed at an at-risk minority population, you liken yourselves to another group that gained popularity in Germany in the 1930s. Rhetoric intended to strike fear into the hearts of the people of this state. I will not sit here and debate your fascist ideology, as peddlers of intolerance deserve no such stage on a public forum. I will not appear for the notion of tax base, of jobs, or business growth in this state.
Thank you.
They are inconsequential of the recognition of the basic rights of your fellow human.
Thank you for your testimony.
The bill is 2 seconds away from the outdated discriminatory three articles laws of the 20th century, and I will not stand for it. We will not stand for it. We may not win today, and we may not win tomorrow, but we will persist, as we always have, in the fight of your oppression. If you wish to eradicate transgenderism from the public life, as members of your party have said, to put on pure ears, you can pry that from my cold, dead hands.
Wow. And we're going to stay in Texas, where the president of West Texas A&M University last week canceled a planned campus drag show. In a letter to students, faculty, and staff, university president Walter Wendler explained, quote, "As a university president, I would not support blackface performance on our campus, even if told the performance is a form of free speech or intended as humor. It's wrong. I do not support any show, performance, or artistic expression which denigrates others, in this case women, for any reason." And in response to the transgender madness sweeping the country, which we've been covering, Arkansas Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders signed a bill into law last week that requires people in public and charter schools in the state to use the bathrooms and locker rooms that match their biological sex, not the sex they want to be. To enforce this law, a person's biological sex is determined by referring to the original birth certificate issued at or near the time of the person's birth. State Representative Mary Bentley, the bill's sponsor, explained the rationale for this legislation.
A lot of constituents are very concerned about the direction of our nation and our state, and they felt like we're just, as our governor said, pretty much gone crazy, and they just really felt it was time for us to push back and make sure that we just had some common sense legislation to make sure children are safe.
And here's another example of pushback to the woke infection attempting to overtake our entire society. The nonprofit Citizens for Sanity has put together a new ad that shows just how crazy woke culture has become. Citizens for Sanity is a political action committee that produces ads promoting conservative causes. It's run by members of the America First Legal Foundation. The ad is spreading through social media like wildfire. Let's watch.
Have you ever boarded a plane and thought to yourself, "I hope the pilot is a transgender refugee"? Have you ever gone to the emergency room and said, "I hope my medical team is incredibly diverse"? Have you ever moved to a new city and said, "I hope the police department hit its equity goals for the year"? If your answer to these questions was no, if you just wanted the most qualified candidates for the job, then you are normal. But we have a lot of very not normal people running America these days. Left-wing politicians believe skin color or gender identity should determine who gets the job. Democrats used to care about the middle class. Now they just care about your race and your gender. And as long as Democrats stay in power, it will just keep getting worse. Stop the bigotry. Stop the insanity. Paid for by Citizens for Sanity.
Well, Steve, have you?
Have I what?
Have you gone to the hospital and wondered?
Oh, yes. Well,
make sure that have you checked out the person? Are you like, you know, there's too many white people here?
You know, Paul, in all honesty, I was thinking about this as we were running just story after story about this lunacy.
Yes. Okay.
And the thought occurred to me that maybe at root, as a country, we just have too much time on our hands.
Yeah.
There, people just have too much time
to waste. Is that what it is?
To take life seriously. I don't know. I think so. I mean, my grandmother, of blessed memory, used to say, "An idle mind is the devil's workshop."
So if we were all starving and being ground down by the boss, we wouldn't be thinking about that stuff.
Well, I mean, if we were experiencing some degree of, I don't know, tribulation or something,
yeah.
I mean, you know, I hate to sound apocalyptic, but you have to wonder what, you know, what goes through people's heads. Because, I mean, actually, what's his name? Gutfeld made a very interesting point, Greg
Gutfeld.
In the monologue in his show last night, where he said, you know, at root, what we have are people who have nothing better to do trying to dictate to ordinary people. So, for example, people who do not have jobs, who do not have children, who do not have to worry about, you know, normal family responsibilities, are trying to take control of the workplace, of the schools, of how we raise our children. You know, by and large, these are people who don't themselves have the experience.
Yeah,
of
or
that.
Children. Some,
yeah,
a lot
and
of
so I just have to conclude that some of it stems from just, you know, maybe we're too well off. I don't know. This is the problem with prosperity. We become victims of our own success.
Yeah, well, I think it also goes back to part of the first conversation we were having is there seems to be a lack of meaning, right? Or at least of legitimate meaning. So everyone has to take up a cross, some sort of crusade. That would you agree that that's, for the most part, that's innate in us, is we are at our best or we feel most alive when we have some sort of meaning, when we stand for something bigger than ourselves.
Yeah, but meaning comes from experience. And I've noticed something. We all know this. You know, people grow up, they're rampaging liberals and idealists all through college. And then when they graduate, get their first job.
Start
paying taxes, worrying about paying debts. Maybe they get married, have children, the responsibilities,
And
begin to accumulate. That brute experience imparts a new meaning to their life. Suddenly they realize life is not about just getting stuff anymore, which they might have supposed when they were children and their parents made all the decisions for them.
What is that Winston Churchill quote, everyone is a liberal until they grow up or something?
it's something to the effect of, you know, if you're under 30 and not a liberal, you have no heart. If you're over 30 and not a conservative,
you have no brain.
Words to that effect.
Well, there we go. We'll end with that. Thank you so much for your time, Steve. And stay tuned, because after this break, we're going to play an interview I conducted with Alex Newman yesterday on the dangers of school vouchers.
I certainly would not want a constitutional convention. I mean, whoa. Who knows what would come out of that?
Just imagine if we have a constitutional convention, the number of people who will be unhappy and the number of people who say the results are not valid, and then they'll just ignore the entire Constitution.
Well, we need just more people that would read the one we have.
It isn't the Constitution that's the problem. It is the people who ignore the Constitution that usurp power and abuse the constitutional power that they ostensibly have.
If you can't enforce an existing piece of paper, how are you going to enforce a piece of paper that has a little more writing to it? In other words, it's been amended.
It's up to us to hold our elected officials accountable.
What can you do to elect good representatives and senators in your state legislature who understand the Constitution and are willing to take a stand?
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The Declaration of Independence proclaims God-given rights, and we intend to protect them. Working with people like you for over 50 years, preserving freedom and building a better tomorrow. Safeguarding the Constitution by limiting government power. We are restoring liberties, educating voters, and leading the freedom movement. Join with us. United, we will defend our rights. We are all Americans. We are the John Birch Society.
Hello, I'm Brandon House. Several years ago, I worked with a team of experts and we developed Extractgevity. Extractgevity is an all-natural energy and health supplement. An all-natural energy and health supplement. I take it every day, and I have for years. It comes in a powder form. You mix it with water and enjoy. It includes bilberry extract, grapeseed extract, red wine extract, and pine bark extract, along with vitamin C. Now, you don't have to take my word for it. Go do your own homework on the benefits of these supplements. And then you can order it at WVWTVstore.com, or you can call 901-468-9357. That's 901-468-9357, or at WVWTVstore.com. I've been taking it every day for years. In fact, a lot of times in the afternoon, I take a glassful because it is that all-natural energy and health supplement. Now, of course, I got to throw out that disclaimer that this product has not been approved or evaluated by the FDA, is not intended to treat, cure, or prevent any disease. But we invite you to check it out at WVWTVstore.com and enjoy Extractjevity, just as I do every day.
So joining me to discuss vouchers, school choice trap, is Alex Newman, a senior editor for The New American Magazine, an award-winning journalist and co-author of the book Crimes of the Educators. Welcome, Alex.
Great to be here. Thank you so much, Paul.
Hey, so Alex, as I mentioned in the opening there, you recently wrote an article in the latest edition of The New American called Vouchers, School Choice Trap. Now, is this in response to the growing number of even conservatives and evangelicals who are falling for this as a response to obviously recognizing that government schools are detrimentally corrupt and they're looking for other choices, but you warn against that?
Yeah, thank you, Paul. And so this article's been a long time coming. I've been meaning to write this for years and years because I've actually seen this, you know, firsthand. I opened up the article with a story, and I didn't say this in the article, but I saw this happen firsthand. I was living in Sweden at the time, and it was a horror show. I watched how the school choice rhetoric morphed from school choice to literally abolishing school choice, using the same exact arguments that we're seeing here in the United States. So I knew this was coming. In fact, Sweden is kind of like a little petri dish where the predators, the elitists, try out their crazy ideas so they can eventually import them to California and then use them all across America. I saw this happen in Sweden. Now I see the same thing happening in America. So better late than never. I wish I had sounded the alarm years ago. And, you know, I have in media interviews and things like that, but this article really needed to be written. We've already had a number of states, including big ones, pass these measures this year so far. And, you know, I know a lot of the legislators involved. I just want to be clear. I think a lot of these people are some of the greatest Americans we have. They're wonderful. They love the Lord. They love our country. They love our kids. They want to get them out of the public schools. But the danger is that we're walking right into a trap. And so, you know, I sound the alarm with nothing but love and you know, the best intentions.
Right. Well, can you explain how the voucher program works?
So there are a number of different programs, and there's been some experimentation. But the general idea, and you know, there are variations on this, but the general idea is that the government will take tax money from your neighbors, and then instead of paying it to the local brainwash camp, to the government-run brainwash camp, aka public school, to brainwash your kids, they'll give you the money, or they'll give a local private school the money, and private, I should put in air quotes, if it's now government-funded, and then they're supposed to provide the education instead of the public school. And so, you know, at first glance, there's a lot to like about this, right? I think anybody who's sensible, who's paying attention, recognizes that what's happening in the public schools is horrific, it's atrocious. In fact, I would argue that it's criminal, it needs to be stopped, the ringleaders need to be prosecuted. And so I think, generally speaking, we're all on the same page here. We've got to get the children out of this wicked, horrible system. The problem is that once they start taking the tax money from the public schools and giving it to the private schools, rather than really offering school choice, what they're doing, and you're going to see this is going to be happening more and more across America, is you're turning the private schools into public schools and thereby eliminating genuine school choice. So there are different programs. You know, they have different ESAs. Sometimes they call it education savings account. Education scholarship account, empowerment scholarship account. They've got different acronyms. And so they'll set up a little account, and the government will give you money into this account that you can then use for qualified homeschool expenses or private schools. And so that's the thinking of how it works. It's kind of like a food stamp, except for education. And in a lot of these states now, it's not just for poor people. It is for absolutely anyone with kids who are school age. And so they're basically making middle class Americans, even the ones who were out of the system before, into government dependents. I mean, they're now, I don't want to say welfare queens because it's got a, you know, bad connotation, but they're basically becoming welfare recipients. And the big danger, again, is that once this money starts flowing, and this is already the case, I mean, this is not some future hypothetical danger. Once the government money starts flowing, regulations, government accountability programs, testing requirements, data reporting requirements, non-discrimination requirements, where you have to hire a guy dressing as a woman to teach your kindergarten class at your Christian school, all of these things come with the money. And so that's the real concern right there, is that by giving tax money to homeschools and private schools, they're inadvertently making homeschoolers and private schools part of the government system that we're all trying to run away from.
Has that happened? You had mentioned Sweden, and I know in your article you mentioned some precedent. Is that how it went down in Sweden and other parts in Europe, where they wanted to be able to take their money and apply it to whatever kind of education they wanted for their children? But then that was the gateway, the conduit for the government to basically get its grubby curricula in there?
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. It happened in Sweden, and I watched it happen. In less than 20 years after they passed the original school choice, which was basically just tax-funded vouchers for anyone who wanted them, they basically nationalized all the private schools. Not officially, right? They're not owned by the government, but the schools must all teach the government curriculum. They must do the same testing. They must do the same gender-bending madness. They actually banned Bible and prayer in even the private Christian schools in Sweden once they started taking government money. So under the guise of school choice, they literally obliterated school choice. They also banned homeschooling in the same bill. And, I mean, it was brutal. They like, went on an airplane and armed agents and kidnapped a little boy whose family was trying to flee the country, try to flee school choice to India to be able to homeschool there. The mother was Indian. So that's kind of the nightmare that ended up there. But Sweden is not the only cautionary tale. Same thing happened in Australia. Same thing happened in South Africa. Same thing has happened in multiple Canadian provinces. And in fact, the same thing has started happening across the United States already. Now, it's not quite as bad yet as some of those other places, but the Government Accountability Office, a congressional agency that looked at these things, said most of the school choice programs require the private schools and the recipients to accept certain government regulations. Now, that varies from state to state, but generally speaking, the courts have consistently held, and we talk about a legal brief that was done on this, courts have consistently held that when public money is involved, it's not just that the government has the authority then to regulate, it's that they have really an obligation, because you can't just be throwing public dollars around and not figuring out what they're going to and where they're going. And so almost all these programs come with some strings attached. Now, we're not Canada, we're not Australia, we're not South Africa, we're not Sweden yet. But ultimately, the regulatory environment will get worse and worse. The freedom, the independence will shrink and shrink until functionally there is no longer any school of choice. And that probably won't happen tomorrow. But we just saw this in Utah as a really good example. And this happened after our article was published, so I didn't include this in the article. But Utah just signed a new bill, Vouchers for Everyone, Universal School Choice, they're calling it. And the ink was not even dry on the governor's signature on this law before the fake media and the advocates and the NGOs and everything started agitating. They're saying, look, we're now funding homeschoolers with public money, but there's no accountability. There's no testing. What if parents teach their kids Nazi stuff, right? We can't have that. We've got to have regulation. And notice they didn't even distinguish anymore between the voucher recipients and the non-voucher recipients. They just said we need regulation over all homeschooling. It's exactly what we saw happen in Alberta, Canada. The government started handing out $500 subsidies. They call it vouchers to homeschool families. And by the very next year, all homeschool families were then subjected to massive, massive regulatory requirements. We're going to see the same thing happening here in the United States. And so that's why I think this is such a critical issue for us to be focused on, even though so many of the people who are on the other side are actually good, decent, God-fearing, America-loving patriots who want ultimately the same thing as we do. These children should be getting a proper education.
Are you saying that in a lot of these countries, homeschooling became illegal or banned by way of vouchers and by way of various government funding for private or other forms of education?
Well, Sweden is the premier example of this. Now, in Nazi Germany, Germany, under Adolf Hitler, the National Socialist regime, was the first in the world to actually criminalize homeschooling, to make it a crime for parents to educate their kids at home, which is quite ironic that today in the United States they're saying, well, people might teach their kids Nazi stuff. We have to ban or regulate homeschooling. Yeah. Actually, that was a Nazi idea. So
it's still illegal in Germany, right? So yep, that's pretty telling, because if you go to like some sort of fact checkers, they'll be like, oh, no, you can homeschool. But then it talks about, but you still have to answer to some authorities on what you're teaching your kids. So it's basically it's illegal to homeschool. Yeah.
Well, anyway, in Germany, you know, after the denazification program, they got rid of most of the Nazi laws. One of the ones that they did not get rid of, one of the policies that stayed in place, was actually the ban on homeschooling. And so Germany today has essentially banned home education in all but the most narrow of exceptions that virtually nobody fits into. The same thing happened in Sweden. Now, in Sweden, it was the early 1990s when they passed the school choice bill, where they started opening up the public coffers to private schools. And it wasn't until 2011, I believe, if I'm remembering my dates correctly, that the trapdoor closed, right, where private schools were nationalized and homeschooling was banned. But the same bill, they call it the Education Reform Act. And I actually called the Department of Education. You know, I called everybody while I was living there at the time. And they just kept repeating the mantra over and over again. Well, you know, the UN, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, says everyone has a right to education. You have a human right to education. And so that means that we have to determine what that education is going to be. So that was the pretext they used in Sweden. They haven't gone that far in some of these other places yet. But as UNESCO explains, we cover this extensively in the article, UNESCO, which is the UN Educational Agency, they actually put out a report less than a year ago now, the Global Education Monitoring Report, where they actually advocate this strategy. They say that governments should start giving tax money to private schools for the purpose of bringing them into the government system, for the purpose of imposing government goals like equity, like testing, et cetera, onto these private schools. So this is not speculation. This is not like looking into a crystal ball, you know, what may be coming. We know this is their strategy. We've seen the strategy in action. Are they going to ban homeschooling tomorrow? Realistically, in most of the United States, the answer is absolutely not. They've got a big and long battle in front of them. But is this a major step in that direction? Nobody should be confused or deceived for a moment. It absolutely is.
Now, let's go back to vouchers. Is vouchers a growing option for folks who are looking for other ways to get their kids educated?
Well, I mean, to go back to what we're saying, it is an option. A lot of states now, especially Republican states, are opening up these types of programs. Florida is, you know, one of the leaders, I guess, if you will, in this field. And it's interesting. Heritage Foundation touted Florida or touted Sweden as a model for the United States early on in this school choice program. They said, you know, how come in socialist Sweden they have school choice but not in America? And yet when they closed the trap door and suddenly all private schools basically became government schools, not a peep out of Heritage Foundation. Well, Heritage Foundation is, again, one of the leading proponents of this. And so when they rank Florida as, you know, being the best or one of the best in school choice and education freedom, we need to keep in mind where this led in Sweden and how Heritage Foundation promoted that. So there are a lot of states now where parents can apply for these vouchers. There are some states where it's basically universally available. Arizona is a good example. Any parent of a school-aged child in Arizona can now apply for these ESAs, and it's universal. And so what we have seen now in Arizona, one of the people I interviewed for the article was the former superintendent of public instruction there. She oversaw all the public schools in the state. She's a wonderful, wonderful lady. She serves on the advisory board for Public School Exit. Great, great lady, Diane Douglas. And she did some analysis for us. And what she said was basically no families hardly left the government system as a result of this voucher program. What did happen, though, is that a rough estimate right now, we don't have exact numbers, but about 10% of the homeschoolers in Maricopa County, one of the biggest, have now ceased to be homeschoolers. And under the state law there, they're actually classified as something entirely new. They're classified as ESA students. They're no longer homeschoolers under the law. They are now ESA students with its own reporting requirements and certainly in the future regulatory requirements. And another point she brings out there is that even though the law specifically says this doesn't give the government any power to regulate private schools, it is going to allow the government to impose restrictions and requirements on parents. And of course, if those parents are using the money to the private schools, the control just flows through the parents to the private schools. So this is happening now. There are a lot of states where parents can get a voucher. And, you know, to be perfectly honest, if I were a parent and I were totally broke and I couldn't find any other way to get my kids out of the public schools, I might reach for one of those vouchers. But I would urge folks in the strongest possible terms to recognize that these vouchers in every single case come with strings attached. As Ray Moore, who I interviewed for the article, said, when you reach for the money, the handcuffs go on. And they may not seem like terribly oppressive handcuffs right now, but they will become more and more oppressive as time goes on.
You know, it reminds me of the COVID shot coercion campaign. I don't know if you remember, but when it went to the Supreme Court, when the Supreme Court said that you can't coerce private companies to take the shot, but it upheld the rule for hospitals and health facilities because they were taking government money, Medicaid and Medicare. And so they said it'd be unreasonable to expect that the government can't impose some sort of standards considering that's where the money's coming from. And it sounds like that's kind of what you're saying. Now, we talked about 15 minutes we spent on what we should not do. And I know that we can't emphasize enough. So what exactly is the answer then? We've established over and over, and I'm for the most part, this is what you do, that government school is corrupt to the core, that it was designed to corrupt your children, to destroy the society. And I think you would agree to go even further to establish a socialist society that can be part of a one world totalitarian socialist society. That's what it's there for. What do we do as parents? Is it as simple as anything that involves the government, any money, any taxpayer money, anything that is even hints of that, you say no? Is it that simple?
I think it is, Paul. And, you know, I would start with an analogy that I've been using for years now that I think is really not adequate, but I can't think of a better one. So if someone thinks of a better one, please send me an email. But my analogy is, look, the building is on fire and your children are inside. If you're talking about policy, if you're talking about wallpaper, if you're talking about school board elections, you're a terrible human being and a terrible parent. If your child is burning, you don't talk about what color the wallpaper is or school salaries or what books are in the library. You run into the burning building and you get your child out. And I think a lot of parents struggle with that analogy because, like, well, you know, I know it's bad. You know, I know they're hurting my kid, but it's not like a fire. Well, it's worse than a fire. It's worse than a fire in multiple ways, because a fire will hurt your children physically. These burning buildings, government brainwash camps, they are destroying your children physically, mentally, morally, emotionally, academically, spiritually, in every possible way. Your children are being destroyed. And so before any other considerations, before figuring out what curriculum you want to use or what private school might be the best for you, whatever, the first thing to do is get your child out of the burning building and, you know, do your best to get them the attention, the professional treatment that they need to deal with the burns that they already have. And that's going to be a long and time consuming process, especially if your children have been in the burning building for a while or even for years, God forbid. You're probably going to have to teach them how to read, right, the proper way. You're going to have to teach them history. You're going to have to start from ground zero because they've had nothing but lies pumped into their mind, nothing but educational quackery pumped into their brain from the time they stepped foot in that educational institution. So first things first, get them out of the burning building. Then, you know, now the child is safe. The child's not going to be burning to death. Now what do we do? Well, you know, that's a time to start thinking about these things. What kind of curriculum do I want to use? How are we going to make this work on one income? Are we going to choose a private school? What kind of private school do we want? What sort of curriculum do we want? All those types of things. Those are good things to think about. Those are important things to think about. But as long as your child's in the burning building, none of those things matter in the slightest. Get them out, and then you can figure out what to do. I would urge in the strongest possible terms that parents do not fall into the trap of getting dependent on the government. You know, just think of it like the cheese in the mouse trap. The reason the mouse eats the cheese is because the cheese looks free. Don't be the mouse, okay? Recognize that cheese is in a trap and you don't want to be part of that trap, and warn other people, right? You fled the burning building for a reason. How silly would it be to go back into the burning building with your kids because there's a piece of cheese in there? It's totally ludicrous. So don't get involved with the government. And we need to really recognize as Americans, as people who love God, that it never was the government's business or responsibility to educate our children in the first place. Just like it's not their business or their responsibility to feed them dinner or to put them to bed at night or to choose what bedtime story we're going to read, it's not their business to be educating them. And so when we start with that correct premise, that it's parents' responsibility to educate and disciple and raise their children, then we end up at correct conclusions, not conclusions like, well, hey, my neighbor's got money. I think I'm going to rob my neighbor so that I can afford to, you know, buy a homeschool curriculum for my kid. No. Your child is your responsibility. It's a God-given responsibility. Take it seriously, and everything else falls into place properly where it should be.
I think that's so crucial, because part of the problem, as I see it, and, you know, I I'm with you and our family. We homeschool, and it's something we did started years ago. But part of the problem is that people don't realize that it wasn't meant to be this way. You know, we've all grown up, for the most part, especially those of us who've grown up in America, like we didn't know any different. Like, it's school, government school has become so ingrained. It is part of American culture. But as you pointed out, it wasn't always like that. And I think, and it's important to note that the generation, those first generations, and obviously our founding fathers, those people were not government school. They were quite the opposite. They were homeschooled. They were privately tutored. And of course, even the largest education or academic institutions were actually made to as Christian colleges and things like that. We have fundamentally changed the fabric of society with education by co-opting education away from the parents, away from private, and selling it over to the government. 5 seconds, Alex, what do you got?
Thank you so much, Paul, for the opportunity to speak on this. Parents, pay attention. Get the latest issue of the New American Magazine. You'll see the article.
Thank you very much, Alex.
Thank you.
The John Birch Society has been working tirelessly since 1958 to preserve freedom, safeguard the Constitution, and restore our God-given rights. We continually educate voters and lead the freedom movement. Join us as we work against a tyrannical one-world government. United as one, we can defeat this conspiracy against a free America. JBS founder Robert Welch said, education is our total strategy and truth our only weapon. Join us in restoring this great nation.
Imprisonment, forced labor, permanent separation from my family, perhaps death. I knew what could happen to people who were caught trying to defect. But the watchtowers stood yards away. The possibility of a new life in a different world, one without tyranny, was within sight. The West. I thought of the rewards no longer crushed under the boot of communism. I would work and make money, no longer restrained by the chains of collectivism. I would say what I wanted, without fear of spies and informants nearby. I would be free. The frozen rain and Romanian mud seeped through my gloves and cloths. I fantasized about a fire burning in the wood stove of my parents' home, but I pushed those thoughts from my mind, closed my eyes, and waited for the cover of the darkness.
Get Defector, a true story of tyranny, liberty, and purpose by Mark Hobovkovich with Paul Dragoo, a thrilling page-turner that will remind you how precious yet vulnerable freedom is. Available at shopjbs.org or Amazon. For a limited time, get 20% off your entire order using promo code DEFECTOR20 when you purchase Defector at shopjbs.org.
You remember when everyone bought all the toilet paper? And they wanted me to wear these things. And someone invested a lot of money into this stuff. They say I'm part of a global plan. I don't think so. It's too hot, it's too cold. You know what? The weather changes. We even hear crazy ideas on how kids should learn.
Here's the news, Dad.
Is it, son? Is it?
What about this one, Dad?
Nope. It's hard to tell what's real and what's fake these days. There's just too much baloney out there. At the New American, they cut through the baloney and give me the truth.
Visit thenewamerican.com and subscribe to get 50% off the cover price.
And next up, here's a legislative update from the John Birch Society's legislative team.
This is Christian Gomez with The New American, and I'm joined again with Peter Rakowski, our research associate here at the John Birch Society. Peter, thank you for joining us here again on the program.
It's great to be on, Christian. Thank you.
Yeah, it's been a while. So today we'll be discussing the education saving accounts in Congress and also what's going on at the state level. So, Peter, there's some bills in the House of Representatives and even one in the Senate. Can you tell us a bit about these bills and why people should either support them or oppose them?
Yeah, so there are several bills in Congress, as you mentioned, H.R. 571, H.R. 463, S-105, and H.R. 609. What these bills in Congress would do is they would promote the concept of education savings accounts, otherwise known as vouchers, where the government essentially gives government funds to parents in order to encourage them to send their kids to either private schools, religious schools, or to homeschool their kids, allowing them to use that money for any education expenses related to that. So what these bills in Congress would do would allow federal funds to be used for ESAs. So federal money could be used to essentially fund parents to send their kids to alternatives outside of government schools.
So on the surface, this looks like a good thing. It gives school choice. So what's so bad about that?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, it sounds like a good thing because ultimately we do want kids to get out of the government schools and to choose either very good private school or religious school options or better yet, homeschool their kids. But in reality, ESAs are actually a really dangerous concept that could actually very much hurt educational freedom and could very much lead to even more indoctrination of kids.
How exactly would that happen? Because you said that this gives them an ability to, the parents that is, to get their kids out of the government schools. How would it be more draconian? Can you explain that?
Well, when the government gives taxpayer money to parents or indirectly to religious schools, the government can then attach strings to that money. So the parents can get the money, but if they want the money, they'll have to adhere to various restrictions. So maybe they will have to teach their kids various, gender ideology, maybe theory of evolution.
Critical race theory, maybe. Yeah. 1619 project type of revisionism. I mean, the book even says on the cover, 1619, a new history, and so forth. So what you're saying basically is that these ESAs, which while on the surface they may look really good, they may even be sponsored by some, seemingly good Republican legislators, but at the end of the day, this amounts to a stealth takeover and regulation of homeschooling and private schooling is what you're saying.
Exactly. And these restrictions, they may not necessarily be there right at the get-go, but this is opening the door to future restrictions. So, for example, maybe a Republican state legislator will enact such a bill. It won't have any restrictions, or at least any major ones, but maybe Democrats will take over the legislature, or maybe there will be some sort of incident that allows people who oppose homeschooling or religious schools to enact restrictions where the money can only be used if parents or the religious schools adhere to various government standards. So, for example, in Utah, they just passed an ESA bill, and immediately after the bill was enacted, various leftists were complaining that the bill did not have restrictions on homeschooling because parents could use that money. So it's really, in Utah and other places, only a matter of time before those restrictions are actually implemented. And we only need to look at countries like Sweden, countries like Canada, Australia, where it originally began the same way. The government passed bills that funded parents, funded private school options. But over time, restrictions were added to these bills, restricting what parents could do with the money, restricting what the religious schools could do with the money. And today, in countries like Sweden, Canada, Australia, and other countries.
Germany.
Yeah, et cetera. The private schools and even the religious schools, Christian schools, Jewish schools, they're basically indistinguishable from the government schools based on what they teach.
They have to meet a certain expectation or guidelines. So basically they become a mirror clone, if you will, of what the government public schools are teaching.
Yeah, and the same thing could happen here if we're not careful. And it's really inappropriate for the government to get involved in education in the first place. So that includes even funding parents.
And in some of those countries you mentioned, homeschooling is outright illegal now, whereas before it wasn't illegal in some of those European countries.
Yeah, Sweden made it illegal around the same time when they implemented these ESA plans. Germany, homeschooling is completely illegal. The private schools, and even the religious schools, as I mentioned, they teach the same left-wing propaganda. So it's, it's really, really a good way of seeing what will happen here.
Okay, so, So we're talking about specifically the federal ESA bills, the H.R. 571, H.R. 563, the S-105 you mentioned, and the H.R. 609. This kind of reminds me of the whole marriage situation and how back in the 90s, the more Republican-leaning Congress with President Bill Clinton passed and signed into law the Defense for Marriage bill, which, you know, was seen as a bill that was protecting the sanctity of marriage being between one man and one woman, and one woman. But now here we have in the last year or so, we've seen the Democrats taking the precedent of the federal government getting involved in the subject of marriage, which is unconstitutional, just like education policy is not something that the federal government belongs to be involved in. Look at Article 1, Section 8. You see no stipulation for marriage, no stipulation for education in terms of what Congress can legislate on. So what does Congress do last year and so forth? They pass the Respect for Marriage Act. So what you're saying is, even if they pass what looks like, what may even be potentially at first, a positive or good, seemingly good ESA-type bill, what could happen in the future is that that bill becomes the precedent for outright draconian overreach, total regulation, maybe even of abolition of certain homeschool curricula and what is taught in Christian, Catholic, and Jewish schools.
Yeah, that is exactly right. So these proposals, some of them sound good from a more conservative standpoint, but we really have to look at, you know, are these bills constitutional or are they not? Do these bills expand the power and influence of government or do they not? And if they're unconstitutional, if they expand government power, then we should oppose them, even if they sound good or even if they sound conservative, because really it's only a slippery slope to even more draconian restrictions.
Now, really quick, we have an alert for state ESAs. Can you tell us a little bit about that alert and what people can do both of these alerts?
Right, yeah. So state legislators are really the main ones enacting these bills. So we've seen states like Arizona, West Virginia, Arkansas, Utah, as I mentioned, and others that have enacted these bills. Many more, such as Florida and Texas and others, are considering these bills right now as we speak. So this alert that we have, it's on jbs.org/alerts, and it's to oppose these bills at the state level.
That one's called Stop State ESAs and Vouchers Don't Shackle Parents with Government Subsidies.
Yes, and it's for all 50 states, regardless of which state you live. You can use it to easily contact your state legislators. And then we have the federal one, as you mentioned, going to Congress, telling them to oppose any federal level version of this.
Okay, well, Peter, thank you for the information you've brought to us today. If you're watching, like he said, go to jbs.org/alerts to find both the federal alerts and the state alerts. And on both the federal page and state page, you'll find the two alerts that we were discussing here today. So thank you and take care and God bless.
And thank you everyone for tuning in to The New American TV. And remember to visit thenewamerican.com for more truth behind the news. Have a good rest of the day and we will see you tomorrow.